It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's what I saw at the revolution, the great culinary revolution of the 1970s. Fresh local stuff on your restaurant plate isn't news now, but 30 years ago, it was groundbreaking. And California chef Jeremiah Tower was one of the cooks who made it happen. His book is California Dish. Well, the ever-trendy Stearns have unearthed unique fusion in New Mexico, New Mex Tex-Mex, along with a very cranky bulldog. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins guides us through the mysteries of sheep cheese. Then a Chinese food expert initiates reporter Scott Haas into the world of the dim sum palace. And we meet a donut who took charge of his life. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
So that be no doubt, call on the north wind to come on out. Then cupped his hands so proudly to shout, la di da di da di dum, 'tis the trees say they're tired, they've borne too much fruit. Charmed all the wayside, there's no dispute. Now shedding leaves, they don't give a hoot. La-di-da-di-da-di-dum, 'tis autumn. Then the birds got together to chirp about the weather. After making their decision in birdie-like precision, turned about and made a beeline to the south. My holding you close really is no crime. As the birds, the trees, and old Father Time, it's just to help the mercury climb. La-di-da-di-da-di-dum, 'tis autumn. The trees say they're tired, they've borne too much fruit. Charmed all the wayside, there's no dispute. Now shedding leaves, they don't give a hoot. La-di-da-di-da-di-dum, 'tis autumn. Then the birds got together, chirp about the weather. After making their decision in birdie-like precision, turned about and made a beeline to the south. My holding you close really is no crime. As the birds, the trees, and old Father Time, it's just to help
the mercury climb. La-di-da-di-da-di-dum, tis autumn. It's just to help the mercury climb. La-di-da-di-la-di-dum. Tis
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, it's the moment that shaped what's on our plates right now. It was the 1970s, it was called California cuisine, and it was a revolutionary idea then. Our guest is Chef Jeremiah Tower. His book is California Dish, What I Saw and Cooked at the American Culinary Revolution. Well, cheese maven Steve Jenkins has The Curious Diner's Guide to Sheep Cheese. Reporter Scott Haas is taken by the hand and led into the world of the Chinese dim sum palace. We meet a pastry with a mind of its own, and as always in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll it out with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, I'm going to tell you about our favorite new restaurant. It's called Sugars, and it's in Embuto, New Mexico, which is about 18 miles from Española, New Mexico. Sugar is not the name of the owner. Sugar is the name of the owner's dog. And Sugar is a really big, mean bulldog. When you dine there, will bark at you, will climb the fence and walk around and look at you, this big, fat, wrinkly bulldog face. It is one of the funniest dogs I've ever seen. I didn't know a bulldog could scale a 6-foot brick fence and walk around on the perimeter of it. But it's so amusing that it almost takes your mind away from the wonderful New Mexican food that they serve there. I mean, as you know, Michael and I are dog lovers, so it doesn't take much to distract us by a cute dog.
Well, I have to say that when we got there, Sugar was actually up on this 6-foot wall, and I thought somehow she had gotten stuck there. You know, because bulldogs are not all that agile.
Right.
So I went over, I found a stick, and I tried to, like, push her off the wall, which may be one reason she was mean and started barking, because I was, like, poking her. And finally, the owner of the place came and said, well, that's where she likes to sit.
Michael, you're so good with pets.
I know.
But tell me about the food.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, Sugars is primarily a Texas-style barbecue. But what it actually offers is something I dare say is a kind of fusion cuisine. Not generally our favorite thing to find, but what it fuses is Texas and New Mexican food in the best possible way. Because what they do there is smoke brisket Texas style. In other words, forever, until it's just falling apart, tender, luscious, drippy with moisture.
Almost pot roasty.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like the best kind of pot roast, just full of beef flavor, like shreds. And then they pile that into an enchilada along with real New Mexican green chilies and a little bit of cheese. And that combination of the green chilies, the cheese, and the beef is just magical.
And not only is it magical, Lynn, but I've never seen it offered anywhere else in the United States. And when Michael said this is a fusion-style restaurant, whenever I hear the word fusion, I always think of something kind of upscale and trendy and modern.
Right.
Sugars is a really small, kind of shack of a restaurant in the middle of nowhere. And
with
it
picnic
is
tables.
With picnic tables and an angry bulldog.
It's not an angry bulldog. It was just angry at me for poking it. Well, I would be barking too
if
somebody was poking me.
If I took a broom and started poking you, you would be mean too.
Do they do other stuff that blends the two areas?
Well, you can also get just plain brisket with a kind of chili hot sauce that to me is not as good. The hot sauce kind of overwhelms the brisket. You know, the thing about Texas brisket at its best is that it is, in fact, powerful as it is, it's also a very delicate flavored food. And to me, the kind of red sauce that you can get on the brisket, either mm-hmm. on a plate or in a sandwich, blankets that delicacy way too much. Mm-hmm. The chili, on the other hand, brings it out. I think you can also get hamburgers, hot
and
dogs,
they
and
have
other
first-rate Frito pie.
Ah, yes.
Do you know, I'm wondering if Sugar the Bulldog is so obstreperous because people feed her all their leftovers, and maybe this dog just eats like green chilies and Frito pie all day.
That can be extremely painful for an animal.
That's what I was thinking.
But I would not be handing this dog anything with my fingers at this point.
No, but I'm going for the brisket with the green chili. And
that's the thing,
and the enchilada. This sounds like it's just dynamite.
It is delicious and really in the middle of Nowheresville, New Mexico.
Well, we're going to get a picnic table. Guys, thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, every week you hear the Sterns here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our free weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every week we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique tips, shopping info. So go to the website and sign up. That's thesplendidtable.org. Cheese expert Steve Jenkins has been hunting down quality artisan cheese for a couple of decades. He's the author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer, and he oversees the cheese counters at the Fairway Markets in New York City. Hey, Steve, it's good to have you back.
Ah, Lynn, it's always so much fun to talk to you.
So what have you been mulling?
I'm mulling sheep's cheeses, and I didn't say cheap cheeses. I said sheep's cheeses.
You're in bed at night, and this is what you're thinking about.
I look at the ceiling and I think about cheese.
So what about the cheese of sheep?
Well, the characteristics of sheep cheeses are that the fat globules are the biggest of any animal's milk. Sheep's cheeses are the richest.
Huh.
Doesn't mean they're the most fattening or the most cholesterol laden, because that's an issue as to how hard the cheese is. Don't forget, Lynn, softer the cheese, the lower the fat and cholesterol. The harder the cheese, the higher the fat and cholesterol. So there's a lot of great, great sheep's cheeses out there that aren't necessarily rock hard like Pecorino Romano
mm-hmm.
that bring such joy to me that there is never an instance where I serve cheese for the people I love to be with that doesn't include at least one sheep's milk cheese.
What are your picks? What do you want us to try?
I want you to know that France and Spain and Italy and the United States offer great sheep's cheeses.
I understand.
In France, the Pyrenees offer sheep's cheeses that are sublime, and there are many of them, from the name brand ones like Prince de Claverolles and Etourqui, to the ones that are actually name controlled that we call Osso Irati, which is a valley and a tiny village, Ossau and then -irati. They'll all say that, and there's a variety of them. Erhaki, which proclaims its Basque Pyrenees origin with its name. Where else would it get a funny name like Erhaki? But then in Corsica, there's the great Brandamore, which another maker refers to as Fleur du Maquis, which is a great, soft, pillow, square-shaped sheep's milk cheese that's coated with the herbs from the Maquis in Corsica, the Maquis being the brambly undergrowth where outlaws hide out and where the game is that results in a lot of the cuisine of Corsica. I'm talking about rosemary and juniper berries and coriander seeds and savory on the outside of this beautiful sheep's milk cheese. Magnificent stuff. And then in Roquefort, Lynn, I get so excited when I think about the Perail, P-E-R-A-I-L, or its branded namesake, Louperac, L-O-U-P-E-R-A-C, is a disc about as big around as a hockey puck, but about a half an inch thick of this beige stuff that you have to eat with a spoon because it's so oozy. It's the cheese that the Roquefort makers make with what little milk they have left over. They make Perail for themselves. Oh, man, they are so fine, I can't even tell you. And even Portugal has got a half a dozen magnificent cheeses that are becoming widely available in shops across the United States, and I urge people to jump all over any Portuguese cheese. It's going to be sheep's milk or a blend of sheep and goat, and they are so fine, I cannot tell you how good they are.
So if it says made in Portugal, we give it a shot.
Exactly. The same way I say if it's made in Catalonia, give it a shot. All you got to do is see the words Catalonia or Portugal on any damn thing. Jump all over it. And don't forget that ricotta is made from the whey that's left over from making Pecorino Romano. Real ricotta is sheep's milk. And if you can find that, or its counterpart, ricotta salata, which is an authentic cheese, you have access to a very inexpensive and magnificently versatile cheese in ricotta salata for salads and for bean dishes and to grate onto gratins and things. And the Greek manouri, M-A-N-O-U-R-I, which I like even better than ricotta salata because it has more of a buttery flavor, is a great, great choice for us to make with sheep's milk cheeses.
Ah, Steve, thank you.
Too much information, not enough time.
Well, Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, you can find his sheep cheese picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And once you get your hands on some sheep cheese, try this. Now, when you pay $15 in a restaurant, it's called bruschetta. When you pay $3 in the supermarket, it's called French bread pizza. I call it garlic bread with sheep cheese and wilted greens. You round up chewy bread, garlic, olive oil, the cheese, some mixed greens, slice up a little onion, have some fresh basil on hand, and all you do is just toast that bread, rub it with garlic and olive oil, and then you pile the cheese on it, a few greens, some onion rings, and the basil. Now bathe the whole thing in olive oil. Sprinkle on that salt and pepper. Run that little sucker under the broiler, and once those things wilt, you pull up a glass of wine, and you've got supper. Coming up, the godfather of modern American cooking, a visit to a dim sum palace, and Arnie, the optimist, who happens to be a donut, as well as open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. What happens in the $200 a dinner restaurant doesn't seem to have anything to do with most of our lives. I mean, most of us are never going to eat in those places. Yet it is in those eateries, at least the brilliant ones, where a domino effect begins, which eventually changes how we eat every day, from the mall food court to what's on the shelves in the supermarket. Now, I'm talking about what the press likes to call culinary revolution. We've seen several in the past 30 years, and one of the cast of characters at these pivotal moments was Chef Jeremiah Tower. Although he was raised all over the world, Jeremiah began his chef's career in the 70s in San Francisco. Well, his memoir is California Dish, What I Saw and Cooked at the American Culinary Revolution. Jeremiah, welcome to the show.
Lynn, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Now, Jeremiah, when you went to school, to college, you didn't study food, right?
No, I didn't, actually. In graduate school, I was training to be an architect with the even stranger notion of becoming an underwater architect.
An underwater architect?
Well, if I told you there are probably two in the whole world now and they're both starving, it tells you why I soon dropped that idea.
So now, from what I understand, you were the first chef at the now very famous Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. How did you get that job?
Well, it's really a story of desperation, how desperate they were and how desperate I was for a job. I was on my way to Hawaii, as I said, to be an underwater architect because I had heard that they were doing a World's Fair floating on the water, and I wanted to put half of it under the water, and I'd ran out of money in San Francisco. And a friend of mine had taken me to this little place. All I remembered about it was the most perfect piece of raspberry tart ever. So when he said, you know, they're looking for a chef, I thought to myself, I mean, so what? But when I realized I had $25 left in my pocket, I thought, you know, so what applied to any job available? So I went over for an interview.
And what happened?
Well, I showed up at 6 o'clock in the evening, which, of course, is an odd time to ask me to come over. But as I said, you know, in those days, I certainly didn't know that that was an odd time to turn up at a restaurant that was open.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, you know, no, come back tomorrow. And I thought to myself as I was leaving, now, wait a minute. They asked me to be here, and I just spent, you know, $5 of my 25 on a round-trip bus fare from San Francisco. I'm going to go back in. And I went back in and was introduced to the woman that turned out to be Alice Waters. And she said, with, you know, the beaming smile, well, you know, something, if you must stay, then do something to that soup. And I tasted it and added salt. And then to show off, I added a little cream and white wine, which I wouldn't do now. But they said, oh, that's delicious. You're a genius. You've got the job.
I said
they were desperate, and I was desperate.
Had you ever worked as a chef before?
No, I never had, but I had cooked a lot in school, and I've been cooking since I was, you know, about 12 or something.
Now, this was the period when Chez Panisse gained its reputation as being the leader in what was to be called California cuisine, right?
Right.
So you were the one who was behind the stove. What were you doing?
Well, for the first 6 months, starting in, you know, late 1972, all I was concerned was, you know, how was I going to make it from one day to the next without everyone finding out I couldn't cook? But I had a fantastic sous chef called Willie Bishop, who was a painter, supporting himself by working in the kitchen. And he knew quantities, which, of course, I didn't for 100 people. And then when that all settled down, I realized we needed to make more revenue, so I started to think of doing regional festivals, regions of France.
Mm-hmm.
And that all ended up a couple of years later for a California regional dinner because I'd run out of regions of France.
So how long were you at Chez Panisse?
I was there until the end of 1978. So the end of 72, beginning of 73, until 5 years.
Uh-huh. And then from there, I'm going to just fast forward, because from what I understand,
sure,
you wanted to open your own place. And to get financing, you were asked by people to sort of revive two restaurants.
Absolutely.
And then from what I understand, that led to you doing this seminal lunch
that the press essentially woke up and said, there's food in America. And then from there you went to Stars, which was your dream.
Yes, that was the dream restaurant, the big American brasserie.
And did the dream actually turn out to be a dream or a nightmare?
Well, that's always a tricky line between dreams and nightmares. A bit of both. But, you know, some of us enjoy nightmares.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Stars was about? What was the goal with Stars?
Stars was everything from blue jeans to black tie. And I wanted people to come in 3 or 4 or 5 times a week for different occasions and feel very easy about it, so that the food, for instance, would be simple, everyday food with a flair, that the bar would be huge and you could sit at the bar and have oysters and champagne. You could sit there and have a hamburger and a glass of red wine. Or you could come in before the theater and after the theater. Or you could sit there and have, you know, a 5-hour fantastic 6-course dinner.
And everybody who was anybody came, didn't they?
When you have a famous restaurant, is, you know, the old saying is that, you know, sooner or later everyone will end up on your doorstep, and it's absolutely true. I mean, we had the Bolshoi Ballet when there were as many KGB around them as dancers, Pavarotti and Barbara Streisand and Joan Collins and Baryshnikov and Nureyev and even President Reagan.
So what happened eventually with Stars?
I had always intended to sell Stars around 1990 when I'd finished paying off the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1989, the earthquake happened. And we were very lucky. I think the only damage, physical damage, was 5 bottles of liquor or something that fell off a shelf. Very lucky. But the really devastating damage that the earthquake did for us was that 4 years later, I think in 1993, 94, they closed the Civic Center. The ballet went away, the symphony went away, the museums were closed, city government was closed, and that cost us about $12 million in sales. So it nearly broke us.
Mm-hmm. So what happened to the restaurant?
Well, the Civic Center in San Francisco eventually came back after 3 years of being closed, and Stars picked up again. Meanwhile, I had looked all over the world for buyers, and in 1998, a friend of mine from Singapore bought Stars, and it continued until he sold it to the chef, and then that continued until about 6 months ago, I think, when it closed. And the scoop is, I'm pretty sure it's true, is that Trader Vic's is going to open there sooner or later.
Everything comes full circle, doesn't it?
Yes, because that's why I used to spend all my money when I first ever started cooking professionally at Chez Panisse. We'd go to the Trader Vic's in the East Bay.
Well, Jeremiah Tower, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Chef Jeremiah Tower's latest book is California Dish, What I Saw and Cooked at the American Culinary Revolution. Our ever-hungry reporter, Scott Haas, checks in with us from all over the world, but today he is home learning the dim sum ropes in Boston with his friend, Chinese food expert and cooking teacher, Bic Nhiang.
I'm standing inside China Pearl, which is one of Boston's largest dim sum palaces. The room is packed with families, people of all ages. I see grandparents sitting with grandchildren. I see young married couples, and it's a flurry of activity. There's small metal carts being brought by waiters and waitresses. Each one of them contains small trays covered in little silver tops. Everything looks and smells delicious. So Bic, what is it true that dim sum means small bites?
A small bite is, if you take the word dim as point, sum is hard. You can say point to your heart's desire.
Oh, so it doesn't mean small bites.
Well, it does too. It's a different meaning also. It means a small, little thing.
When you say point to your heart's delight, it makes sense because people are coming by with carts for the entire time, and just you point to it and you want it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of them, they don't know the real name, and they get so intimidated. Actually, you don't have to. You just have to recognize what does it look like, the shape, and when a cart wheels by your side, and you just ask them to open it up and just take a look at it.
Well, the other thing, too, is that a lot of the wait staff don't speak English adequately, and a lot of people from outside of the community don't speak Chinese adequately, so just by pointing, you're okay.
Yeah, it's fine. They understand you completely. You know, food is like international language. But just open it up, they know, they understand that you want to take a look at what it is.
So a cart has come by with little bamboo baskets. What's this?
Ha gao siu mai. That's a shrimp dumpling and a pork dumpling. This is a pork. You see this?
Those are beautiful. They're
it's a noodle skin.
Wrapped in a noodle skin with little mushrooms and little bits of pepper. Yeah. And to the left of these are these almost crescent moon-shaped dumplings filled with shrimp. I'm gonna taste this. My dumpling is falling apart.
Well, you can use a chopstick. You can use it just like a Chinese.
It's difficult.
You know what they say to you, Scott?
No, tell me.
The major D is sitting us down and we're telling the waiter, like, give you a fork.
Give me a fork. Well, that's very nice of him. I appreciate that. It was very kind. Well, this has a very earthy, almost smoky flavor. It's delicious.
That is like jicama.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever had jicama in a Chinese restaurant.
Oh, jicama is a pretty popular.
Now, one of the other things I notice about the room today, and I've seen this on dim some other times too, is you hardly see one person eating by himself or herself.
It's nice to have like 4, 5, 6 people together for dim sum because you can sample different things. If it's 2 people, you couldn't eat that much. And that's why there's like Spanish called tapas. Like dim sum is little thing, little dishes. And so that's why you sample different things. So it's great with, like, you see the portion come in like 3 or 4 little pieces of the pastry.
Oh, what's this?
Taro dumpling. Taro. They cook the taro. Taro is like potato, and they cook them first and mush them, so they will pat them like a skin, like mashed potato.
It looks like a almost a croquette, and you're saying inside it's the mashed taro, and then there's this almost feathery, shredded wheat type texture. What do I do? Can I pick it up with my hands, or?
Yeah, you can eat it with your hand. Perfectly fine. Use your hand in a Chinese restaurant to eat.
Really? They won't look at you and like they'll make fun of you quietly behind? No.
Oh, it tastes better.
Well, that's just delicious. I could live on that every day. It's a nice crunchy texture, and inside it's almost like a almost like a mashed potato type, not mashed potato, like a whipped potato texture. But the flavors are very subtle and they're very long flavors.
It's a comfort food.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah. And how many dishes do we have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Oh, we only have 8 dishes. It's not much.
Not much. We have to keep working here.
Yeah.
You know, what's interesting too is that there's no menu for dim sum, at least at this restaurant. Many restaurants don't have a menu. So it really becomes an immediate experience. And what's enjoyable, too, is that you end up having your appetite satisfied just by looking and smelling. You don't even have to eat that much. I don't see people eating ridiculous quantities of food. People are eating very slowly and thoughtfully.
Well, Scott, you didn't see that because the waiter kept coming over to take the place away, so you forgot how many dishes you have.
They're hiding the fact, are they?
Yeah. But it is a good way to meet friends, and that's why that weekends, especially weekends, everybody, people coming from the suburbs, and they will meet friends here for dim sum before they go or do the grocery shop.
Well, Vic, I want to thank you for educating me about the significance of dim sum and its role in your culture and the broader culture.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Reporter Scott Haas is based in Boston. Chinese Food Authority Vic Nyang teaches, consults, and leads culinary tours there. Now, you can find information on Vic and her tours on the website, splendidtable.org. constantly told to think about what we eat because of health or a ton of other reasons. Well, have you ever thought about what your food thinks? The children's book Arnie the Donut is about a pastry with a mind of his own. It's a picture book with wonderfully wacky drawings and talking comestibles baked up by author and illustrator Lori Keller. Lori, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Lori, what made you think about doing a book about a donut?
Well, it came on kind of unexpectedly. I went into a Krispy Kreme donut shop for the first time, and I was just blown away by the whole process, because I don't know if you've been into one, but you can actually watch from the very beginning how donuts are made, from the time they're little rings of dough to the time that they're full-fledged donuts. And I stood there just fascinated by the whole process. And I walked home with my big box of donuts in one hand, and I thought of the basic idea for Arnie the Donut. I didn't think my editor would really go for it. I was working on another story idea, and I kind of kiddingly told her the next morning. I called her, and she really liked it, and so she told me to go ahead with the idea.
So the main character of the book is Arnie the Donut. So, Lori, what's Arnie's personality like?
Arnie's a very optimistic donut. He's just so excited to find out, once he's become a donut, that he's turned out to be the kind of donut that he wanted to be, which was a chocolate-covered sprinkle donut. And he just can't wait to find out who's going to choose him.
What a gregarious little character
he is. Definitely is.
Now, I don't want to give the story away, but I would love if you could please read about Arnie has been purchased, and he's been taken home, and he is now with his purchaser, Mr. Bing.
Right. Mr. Bing carefully removed Arnie from his paper bag and placed him on a clean, shiny plate. What a handsome plate, Arnie said to himself. I'm not crazy about the design. I prefer a more modern look, but it's nothing a little paint can't fix. Mr. Bing gently lifted Arnie from his new plate. Isn't that cute, thought Arnie as he closed his eyes and smiled. He wants to hold me. As Arnie relaxed in Mr. Bing's hand, he felt himself moving higher and higher away from his plate. When he opened his eyes to see where he was going, he discovered that he was headed straight for Mr. Bing's open mouth. What are you doing? Shouted Arnie. Mr. Bing was stunned. He dropped Arnie back onto the plate. I was going to eat you, he replied in shock. Eat me? Arnie shrieked, his sprinkles flying everywhere. Why would you do a thing like that? Do you make a habit of eating all your house guests? No, of course not. So why then did it suddenly occur to you to eat me? Arnie demanded. Well, because you're a donut. That's what donuts are for, to eat. Do you mean to tell me that you've done this before? Yes, I eat a donut every day, Mr. Bing said sheepishly.
You know, isn't this kind of macabre?
Well, I guess it kind of looks that way, but there's a very happy ending. I won't give it away. And I do make a point in the book to let kids know that all the other donuts are absolutely fine. In fact, they're excited about the idea of being eaten, and they know that they're delicious, and that's why they're here.
So now you don't feel guilty eating donuts?
Oh, never.
Okay.
No way.
Hey, Lori, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Illustrator and author Lori Keller cooked up the book Arnie the Donut. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Here's the question. Every month, a naked chef appears in a full-page ad in the super slick chef magazine Food Arts. Well, what's the ad selling? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, every month, a naked chef appears in a full-page ad in the super slick chef magazine Food Arts. Well, what's the ad actually selling? Well, they're pushing the oversized VitaPrep blender. And oversized is a good thing in this case, since each chef holds the blender in front of the strategic area of his or her anatomy. Now, the series has its very own calendar, and it's all very tasteful. No pun intended. Star chefs actually line up to do this one. And does anybody care about the blender in the ad? Most people can't remember its name. But if you do check it out, brace yourself. VitaPrep commercial blenders sell for $750. They make claims about changing your life. Now, I figure you're going to run around your kitchen naked, but be careful because you can get some really nasty burns that way. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Lee on the line. So, Lee, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I was in Las Vegas not too long ago visiting my son in the Air Force, and he had this this meal that had a demi-glaze in the sauce.
Right.
And my wife is sort of vegetarian, and I was wondering if you could come up with a way of making a vegetable demi-glaze.
Okay. A demi-glaze today is usually a really rich broth that somebody has reduced down to the point that you could coat a spoon with it.
Exactly right.
You know, it's glossy and it's very rich tasting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sure. All right, you want a vegetable one?
Yeah, I've looked on the internet and I sort of got a feel for how they come together and the time involved in doing so, but I haven't found any ingredients that would go in a vegetable one.
Well, I have a vegetable broth in my second book and it's pretty delicious. I'll give you the basic idea. You take something like a 6 or 8 quart pot, mm-hmm. and you just put a little bit of olive oil in it, and you put in chopped up celery, carrot, and onion. And if you have any white mushrooms, you know, just normal everyday mushrooms, throw those in.
Uh-huh.
And saute that for about 10 minutes. You don't want it to really brown. You right. just want to get it nice, just starting to turn golden. Mm-hmm. And then you throw in a few tomatoes. You throw in some garlic, a couple of cloves,
okay.
a couple of romaine leaves because it sweetens and lightens the broth.
Okay.
And, you know, romaine is this nice green. It's not quite insipid, but it's
right.
not going to kill you. And some white wine. And you simmer that for about an hour. And then strain it. Okay. Now, to make the demi-glaze really rich, what I want you to do is you're going to do sort of a double sauce thing here. You have the strained broth. It tastes great. Don't put any salt and pepper in it yet.
Okay.
Now, take chopped up celery, carrot, and onion and slowly brown it a bit in butter.
Okay.
Pour some white wine and boil it all off. Okay?
Gotcha.
And then add the broth and then cook it down. Now, you can strain it if you want, but you cook it down until it's quite thick and it coats the spoon. Not really thick. It's syrupy.
Right, gotcha.
And by the way, you can freeze this in any stage you want. You can make the broth ahead, and then you can do the browning and put the broth with it, and you can make the demi-glaze, but it'll all freeze beautifully.
Oh, sounds great.
And you could stash this in the freezer.
Sounds more simple than what I thought. I didn't know what vegetables to pick out was the problem.
When in doubt, always go for celery, carrot, and onion. They will stand you in good stead through life.
Can't go wrong with those, huh?
Hey, you take care.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Okay, guys, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Grace calling. Grace, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I love your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm calling about mâche lettuce. Last month, I was in France visiting my relatives, and almost every night we had salad made with mâche. And I was also there a couple years ago and forgot how much I love this stuff because it's so mild and tasty, and I wish I could get it in the States.
Uh-huh.
Well, I did find mâche for sale at our Larry's Markets here in Seattle, but it was this teeny tiny bag, and the mâche was all brown, and it was $5. So my question is, what can we do to get the word out about how fabulous this stuff is?
There's some people, I think they're in California, that are doing bagged mâche that I've tried that wasn't bad. But I must tell you, you're right, it's pricey.
Mm-hmm.
For those who haven't tried it, it's a little almost heart-shaped green leaf. It's mainly grown traditionally in the spring. It's one of the first signs of spring in Europe. It's also called corn salad, and it has a lovely green but not terribly strong flavor. And what I love it with is Belgian endive. Talk about two pricey ingredients. And evidently, it is expensive because it's hard to harvest. Now, one thing you might be able to do, in Europe, it used to be sold in little plastic containers where it was growing in soil. And I wonder if you couldn't get your hands on some seeds and just try growing your own in a windowsill.
Oh, I would love to do that if I could find the seeds.
I think you'll find the seeds go online, take a look at anybody that's doing organic seeds is going to probably be selling mâche seeds.
Oh, that's a good idea. Yeah. I wonder why it's so less expensive in France, because we were buying big bags for 2.5 euros.
Well, I think the thing is there's such a huge demand for it,
mm-hmm.
a huge demand. But and by the way, someone just mentioned in my ear, Cook's Garden and Shepherd Seeds, two places to look. Okay.
Cook's Garden and Shepherd Seeds.
Yeah. Now to get enough mâche to really satisfy you, you may have to have every windowsill mm-hmm. in the house going. But still, I think it grows pretty fast.
Well, that's a great idea. I'll try that, and then I'll hope to find it in the grocery stores more often in the future.
Hopefully. We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Thanks very much.
You take care.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
I'm picturing bringing in the North 40, you know, going up to the bedroom and harvesting from the windowsill. 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. Give us a call. We have Christy on the line. Christy, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. Bavaria is up.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
I'm going this Saturday. And by the way, I've loved your show for so many years.
Hey, thank you.
You totally
thank you.
Encouraged me. But I'm going to be in Munich, and I want to know, what do I eat?
Oh, you know, this may sound corny, but when you're in Munich, you eat sausage.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, nobody in the world does sausage like the Germans. And for my money, nobody in Germany does sausage the way the people in Munich do.
Oh.
Now, I haven't been there in years, and I know, you know, there's this whole thing in Germany, it's been going on for a decade now, of fabulous restaurants, new food, etc. And of course, the beer is unbelievable, and the dark bread could make you weep. And if I were you, I would bring home a collection of mustards.
Ooh, German mustards.
German mustards. And there's pastries, and the other thing that's wonderful there... Aren't you sorry you asked? I mean, really.
I'm hungry.
Oh, Christy, there's a great tradition of spice breads and gingerbreads and ginger cakes and cookies.
Oh, my.
And some of them you actually eat in the morning with fresh cheese on them.
Oh, I could do that.
Yeah, and the gingerbreads range from moist and cake-like to almost fudgy. You know, and then into the cracker, the biscuit, this kind of thing.
Oh.
Do you know it was old baby food? People, the apothecary made gingerbread, and when it got very crisp, they pounded it, and they made it into pablum for babies.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, you may want to bring that home for a child in your life.
My. Well, Lily will like that. Oh, thank you so much.
Christy, you have a blast.
Awesome. Thank you, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Munich in September and October. Ah! Oh, I can see the cuckoo clocks now. Head into the Black Forest. Okay, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Fred calling from Watsonville, California. So, Fred, what's up?
Hi, yeah, I'm interested in finding a recipe for marshmallows. made in the traditional, old-fashioned way that I'm not even actually positive exists. I've been asking for this for years, but I know that marshmallows were originally made from the root of the marshmallow, which is the plant that's cultivated in Italy as malva, as mm-hmm. a pot herb, and is grown as an ornamental as well. But I'm sure that's what marshmallows were first made from. And I just would love to have a natural marshmallow that doesn't have chemicals in it.
Well, okay, I've come across the same kind of information, Fred, that originally it was made from the root of the marshmallow. And some of what I've seen is that root was scraped and it was pulverized. And I think there's actually almost a sappy interior to it that was then whipped. This is a long time ago, with honey, but really whipped. You know, it was done by hand. I make sort of a modern day marshmallow that's done with something, you know, clear corn syrup and gelatin and sugar and flavoring. But I've never tried the other one. Mm-hmm. But the modern, you know, I want to call it the modern purists' approach to the marshmallow, a homemade marshmallow. And by the way, they are dynamite and they are great conversation pieces, is that essentially what you do is you combine corn syrup and sugar with a bit of water and you make a sugar syrup. You take it up to about 248 degrees.
Right.
You use a thermometer to do this. Uh-huh. And in the meantime, you have some more corn syrup in a mixer, you know, an electric mixer. It could be handheld or it could be, you know, a tabletop thing. And when you get to 248 degrees, oh, and you've melted a bit of gelatin. And when you get to 248 degrees, you pour that hot syrup into the beating corn syrup. And then you keep beating and beating, and then you add the melted gelatin. And it's like magic. All of a sudden, you've got a white, billowy, lusciously sticky, and you can throw flavorings in there.
Right.
And you just spread that out on a bed of, you've sifted together cornstarch and powdered sugar. And you spread it out on a bed of that, you know, maybe you have it on some paper or, you know, some wax paper or some foil. And you can even put it in a pan. And once it sets up, you cut it and you just sort of toss it with the powdered stuff so that it doesn't stick. It's fabulous.
Well, I mean, I think this would be the ideal thing for Nell Newman to take as her next Newman's Organic Product Challenge.
I think you're right.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
I love the questions with the historical bents. Call us, 800-537-5252. Speaking of love, if you love to bake, there is a new website out there, and it's really worth checking out. It's on the site of the French Culinary Institute, which is trains professionals, and it's called pastryscoop.com. And it has all kinds of information about pastry for professionals and amateurs alike. Techniques, and there's videos of techniques, and there's recipe hookups. So pastryscoop.com. Okay, back to the calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Susan calling from Rio Frio, Texas. Susan.
Hello, I'm here.
Susan, I have to ask you a question.
Yes.
Rio Frio sounds like a dish. What is this place about? I mean, are Fritos made there?
It's Spanish for cold river.
Oh, of course. Rio River Frio Cold.
Yeah.
Ah. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking it's short for Fritos or...
Well, actually, sometimes we do say Rio Frito.
Fried river. Okay.
Right.
By the way, did you call with a question by any chance?
I did. I once lived in France, and I discovered quince there.
Oh, yeah.
We made a preserve out of quince, which was just beautiful and tasted great. And we mixed this in the wintertime when we didn't have fresh fruit. We mixed it with cream. And had the most luscious dessert I've ever had.
What could be bad?
Oh, it was wonderful. And I would just like to know, I see quince in the grocery stores here, but I don't know you know, yes, I know how to make jam from it. What else can I use it for?
Well, quince, and if anybody's not familiar with quince, it looks like a squat pear got mated with an apple. And,
yep.
And it can smell perfumey and luscious, but you always have to cook it. It's as hard as a rock,
right?
And it's work to peel and it's work to core, but it always needs cooking. You don't eat it raw, but it turns these beautiful colors of almost, not garnet, but pale pink, and almost some of them are a little on the golden side, right? And it just, I can't explain it, but it's like all the exotic things you've dreamed of. But anyway, enough romancing. Whatever you do, you want to cook quince for about anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half. But one of the great things to do with it is to use it with meats and poultry. And I'm thinking of things from North Africa. For instance, a lamb stew where you take spices, you take things like Moroccan spices, you know, sweet paprika and coriander and cumin and lots of garlic and fresh coriander, and you put wedges of quince into that combination with cinnamon. And all you do is just lightly sauté the lamb, add all of those things, sauté them together, add water or broth, and just let that simmer. And the lamb should be almost, I mean, it should still have some firmness to it, but it should almost melt in your mouth. And you serve that with couscous, and you will think you've died and gone to heaven.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah. A quince is wonderful with lamb. It's wonderful with pork. It's fabulous with chicken. Fabulous. If you do a pot roasted chicken, you know, put brown the chicken in a deep pot, throw in celery, carrot, onion, and then cut up chunks of quince and put in a few cinnamon sticks and lots of black peppercorns. Oh, you know, and add wine and just let that simmer.
Ooh.
Or
what
just
kind of wine?
In that case, I think I'd go for a dry white because I want the color of the quince to come through. And the other thing you can do with quince is just cut it into slices or wedges. Put it into a generously buttered shallow baking dish, pour in white wine and honey, throw in a few pieces of allspice and a vanilla bean, cover that up, and slow bake in the oven for about an hour until they're tender. You can just pierce them easily with a knife.
Oh, man, that sounds great.
And then if you were to add cream to that, you might come close to your, you know, your fabulous dessert from France.
That's right.
Okay.
Sounds great. I have to run down and buy some quince.
Now that Rio Frio is starving to death for quince. Hey, Susan.
I don't know if Rio Frio has heard of quince.
Well, you're going to introduce them to it.
We're just going to have to introduce them. Well, thank you so much. I enjoy your program.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for calling.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. Just dial up 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from actress Helen Hayes. She said, "Age is not important unless you're a cheese." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, take a look at our free newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to make your weeknight cooking a little easier. Register for it online at splendidtable.org and let us know what you think about it. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Dim Sum Piece was produced by John Marston. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.